sensorial group field theory. Tobin?
Okay, thank you. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on your country. So today I would like to talk about renormalization of tensorial group field theories. This is work done in collaboration with Daniele Oditti and Vincent Rivasso. So you probably, most of you probably already know what group field theories are and probably wondering why we added the term tensorial. And this is mainly because we are exploring some models where we changed a bit the combinatorics of the usual spin foam and group field theory models. And these models rely a lot on recently unraveled analytical techniques from tensor models. So please go to slide number 2, where I give some motivations for this work. So these tensorial group field theories can be seen as coming from two directions, either first the tensor models, which are tentative generalizations of matrix models, which were quite successful in describing random geometries in two dimensions. So it was very natural in the 90s to generalize them to higher dimensional tensors and geometries. However, the progress was very slow in this direction, mainly due to a lack of analytical control on these models. In particular, the 1/n expansion that were so crucial to matrix models was missing and was only discovered recently, mainly by Razvan Gurao. And this gave tools just like universality probability theorems, very similar to the central limit theorem, that gave open the possibility to construct full-fledged field theories out of these tensor models. The second route is by spin foams and their group field theory formulation. There, if not necessary, but most of the time you start by trying to quantize simplicial geometries and recover the continuum from some approximations. One of the issues is that contrary to state sum models, usually the triangulation independence is not ensured, and so you need some refining procedure, such that the lattice gauge theory limit explored by Fitch and vectors, or you need to sum all the possible combinatorial structures that are available in the model. So the prescriptions, a prescription for the second of these possibilities, and how is just by interpreting the usual spin foam models as Feynman amplitudes of a quantum field theory of a particular kind that I will describe. The main issue here, as in any quantum field theory, is that amplitudes are generically divergent. So you might wonder whether renormalization technique could play a role here. And from general expectations, we want in the end to relate these discrete models to the continuum approximations that we experience in everyday life. And as such, we can expect the relevant vectors of the models to be described by many degrees of freedom, and renormalization techniques could here again play an important role. So the long-term question we would like to answer in an tensorial group field theories is whether we can construct renormalizable models, that is, quantum field theories that really make sense, that can be defined, and whether in this framework, by studying the flows of these models, whether we can find some, for example, a phase transition from a discrete phase to a continuum phase, and if it's if in this phase we can recover physics which look like physics of GR. So please go to slide 3.
Can I ask a question on slide 2 already? You mentioned sort of in the middle of the slide that the idea of group field theory would be to perform the sum, right? Instead of taking kind of a gauge theory kind of limit. But in the last point, you are again talking about continuum limit. So if you perform a sum, why do you have to take a continuum limit?
What I mean by, so the sum is really to make the amplitude independent on the bulk. What form you use to interpolate between two states of geometries. But in the end, we want to describe discrete geometries. So even on the boundary, you should plug more continuous states. This is what I mean by that. And so you would like to describe states with many, many degrees of freedom on the boundary.
Right, but so this is not the same as the sum over spin forms then?
What do you mean?
I thought that sum over spin forms was precisely the kind of things that people in Marseille were doing, right? And namely that really summing over all possibles are at least proposing to do, summing over all possible spin forms. Then there's no, I mean, just like in the loop quantum gravity, right, where one just takes this projective limit, it's like looking at, the theory is already in a continuum. One is just taking a projective limit of the whole thing. So this is not what you want to do. You want to really take a continuum limit more. I'm trying to understand your viewpoint.
So we want to do both. We want first to define the model appropriately so that we have an ambiguous amplitude between discrete geometry states. So
this is for a given simplicial, decomposition or given too complex between the final and the initial and the final state, and then you are summing over J's. Is that what you mean by sum? Or by sum you mean you're also summing over all skeletons?
We are summing on all skeletons. So we want to fix some boundary geometry and then define the amplitudes as a sum over all the possible spin form interpolation between the two boundaries with some appropriate.
So your viewpoint is that fundamentally there is no continuum, that there is no discrete structure, even in the boundary states?
I don't have any strong things to say about this, but probably...
If you take a continuum limit, that's what you're saying, isn't it?
I mean, whether you interpret the discrete structures as fundamental or not, I think that... In the end, you need to define some approximately continuous geometry. So this is what I mean by continuum limit. So whether you think of the lattices, the discrete structures as approximations or fundamental, you need such kind of a limit, in my view.
Okay. So you would be happy if, in fact, there is a fundamentally discrete structure, but the states are such that and continuum is actually an approximation. So you don't fundamentally want to take the continuum limit, but you want to recover continuum limit as just an effective field theory. Is that, you would be happy with that or would not be happy with that?
Pretty much so, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So thanks. Please go to slide number 3. So the state of the art in tensorial group field theories is, so there are mainly one set of models that have been recently studied by Rivasso, Benjeloun, and Samari. They are of the simplest type, that there is no geometric degrees of freedom in the sense of connections or geometric operators, but they are purely combinatorial models, and they could be proven to be renormalizable. And even asymptotically free, so they could make sense as a fundamental theories in a sense. The question we want to ask in this talk is what happens if we start adding the geometrical ingredients that are so crucial to spin forms, and in particular the notion of discrete connections, so holonomies and the amplitudes. So let me start with the conclusion. The main message of this talk is that indeed it's possible to introduce holonomies in the picture, and it generically improves renormalizability. And also on the way, we need to generalize some key QFT notions, including connectedness, locality, and what it means to contract a graph in a bigger graph. So I will present two main examples. One is a set of U1 super-normalizable models in four dimensions. So that is already published, on the archive. And the second example is a Gersony-normalizable model of the Bulotov type in three dimensions and with group SU2. So this model might be relevant in 3D gravity, but I don't want to make bold statements. We don't know yet what is the precise relation between this model and the Pontano-Rege model. So please go to slide number 4. So here is the outline of my talk. I will start by presenting the general class of models we are considering so far. Then I will present the main tool that we use in renormalization for these models, which is called the multiscale expansion. And then I will present some of the features of the two models, two sets of models that I just talked about. So please go to slide number 5 and 6 even. So what is the general structure of a tensorial group field theory? So this is a theory of one dynamical variable, which is a rank D complex field defined on D copies of a compact Lie group. And then you define a dynamics by a partition function for this field. And we write this partition function Z as an integral over a Gaussian measure, mu c, times the exponential of minus the interaction part of the action. So beware that in this talk, S is the interaction part of the action. And the kinetic part is put in the Gaussian measure, the mu c. So to address the question of renormalizability and definition of these models, we need to decide to find a prescription for the writing interaction terms, somehow a symmetry principle that defines what will be the local terms, what we will call local terms. And all the dynamics and the additional geometrical constraints will be implemented by the Gaussian measure, and which is fully characterized by the second moment, C, which is the propagator of the theory. So in the next couple of slides, I will describe for you the possible choices that we can make and the ones we have made in this work. So please go to slide number 7. Here. Yes?
It's Laurent. It's about this notion of local term. Maybe you're going to expand on that, but a priori, GFT is a, you know, there's no preferred notion of locality. It's a non-local field theory. So are you going to explain us why you use this local expansion?
Yes.
Where it comes from? I mean, in usual field theory, it's built in somehow, the definition, but here it's not obvious.
Yes, I'm going to try to give a flavor of why we make choices in the next slide, slide number 7, if you want. So in slide number 7, usually in spin forms, what is chosen as interaction is a simple shell interaction that generates for you a simple shell complexes. And the counterpart in GFT is an interaction of degree d plus 1 that mimics the construction of a simplex from a lower dimension simplices that are represented by the fields. So here I've given the example in 3D. So you see that the interaction is of order 4. And each of the copies of the fields in the interaction is interpreted as a quantized triangle, which are identified along the common faces to form a tetrahedron. And the faces are identified by the group elements, which are convoluted together. So you see that the picture, the tetrahedron represented here, is a representation of the interaction that I've written for you. However, in this picture, at least from the GFT point of view, there are problems, because on the one hand, it's a good prescription because you can generate any kind of simple shell complex from it. But for the same reason, you don't have a full control on the topology of the simplicial complexes, and you can generate very wild and degenerate topologies. So a way out of this mess that presented really a progress in this direction in the understanding of the combinatorics of the usual models has been to add the colors. So this is the work of Razvan, who instead of one field and introduced d plus one copies of the fields, so that the interaction now is linear in each of the fields, and restricts the sum of the simplicial complexes to a sum over a subset of nicer simplicial complexes that would simplicial complexes which don't have so many degenerate configurations. And even more recently, it was discovered that actually in the simplest models, the simplest tensor models, you could integrate out D fields out of the D plus one fields and obtain an effective theory in the one remaining field that could be well described by a symmetry principle called tensor invariance. So because the choice of combinatorics in GFTs and in spin forms in general, it's a bit, it's not fully motivated from first principles. We feel that it's a good idea maybe to reverse the logic and start from tensor invariance. So this is shown in slide 8. So we now assume that the interaction part of the action is a tensor invariance, and the reason for that is that they provide a good combinatorial control over the topologies, and this way you generate only pseudo-manifolds, which are quite regular topological spaces, and you have all the combinatorial the analytical tools of colored field theories, colored group field theories at your disposal to study the models. So this is what I mean by what we mean by locality in this framework. It's just a symmetry principle that tells you which interactions you are allowed to work with, and defines whether you can reabsorb the divergences in these so-called local terms. So of course, it's a bit to answer your question, Laurent. It's a bit arbitrary, but I would say not more arbitrary than working with one simplicial interaction. So we want to explore this kind of models. So let me explain more in detail what is the tensor invariance. So we assume that
just a question. So because by local I thought that you were meaning that somehow you're going to do some kind of derivative expansion in terms of G. So you know, the first terms will be contact term was G1 is equal to G prime, and then you will. So that's not what you mean. If you take any arbitrary invariant, then they are non-local in G space. So when you mean local, just clarification. You don't mean local in G space.
It's not even space-time locality. It's not related to space-time locality.
I'm not talking about space-time. I'm talking about the space of G. The space of the group element that you integrate over. For instance, if you look at the interaction you wrote on your slide, at the bottom you have that there are two fields where G1 arise, and then you know you put G1 and G1. For instance, you don't put G1 and some and G1 prime with some kernel, non-local kernel. That's what I'm saying.
No. The non-local kernels will be put in the propagator, as I will explain.
But local, okay. So that's what I'm trying to understand. There's the notion of tensor invariance, which is one thing, and then there's the notion of locality on manifold space. Do you mean the two are the same, or?
Let's say to emphasize an analogy with usual quantum field theory, where you call local the interactions that verify Poincaré invariance. So here we are given another kind of invariance, and therefore we are tempted to call them local because it has nothing to do with locality on the space G.
Okay, nothing to do with locality on space G. Okay.
So these tensor invariants are can be constructed from decolored graphs. So I've given an example on the slide. And so they are regular graphs with Valencity, which are bipartite and edge-colored. And let me explain how you construct an invariant from the graph. So each white dot is associated to a field, phi, and each black dot to a conjugate field, phi bar. And to each of the colored lines, you associate a convolution between the corresponding indices. So for example, a line of color 1, represented in red on the slide, represents a convolution of the first indices of two fields. So what this tensor invariant means is really that you should interpret the fields not as symmetrized tensors, but as unsymmetrized tensor. And so therefore you want to contract these tensors only index by index. You have to be careful of which position is in which position each index is. So please go to slide number 9. So now we have clarified what we mean by locality. Now let's look at the Gaussian measure. So usually you expect the Gaussian measure to implement all the geometrical constraints you want to implement in your spin form. For example, the one which is common to all of the spin forms is the gauge symmetry that gives you a notion introduces the holonomy at the level of the spin forms. And in 4D, for example, you would have to add also the simplicity constraints. So from this point of view, you would be tempted to define the Gaussian measure, the covariance, as a projector that from an arbitrary field projects it down to some geometrical space of fields. And this is the case, for example, in 3D gravity, where the covariance is really a projector, as shown in slide number 2. This is the projector that projects an arbitrary field to the gauge invariant field of equation 1. But this projector's prescription is not always possible in practice, because, for example, in 4D, when you have the Barbero-Immersi parameter, simplicity and gauge constraints might not commute, so C is not necessarily a projector. And even when C is a projector, such as it's the case in 3D, as soon as you introduce the cutoff you need to regularize the model, this property is lost. And as a result, as was shown in a paper by Joseph Benjeloun and Valentin Bonzon, if you want to make the theory independent of this cutoff, you need to introduce additional operators, differential operators in the residue corrections. So we will depart from this propagator framework, projector propagator framework, and use the fact that the propagator might not be a projector as an advantage, because as you know, when already in usual field theories, the spectrum of the propagator is really the energy, and it gives you a built-in notion of scale. So this will be the notion of scale we'll be using for defining randomization steps. So please go to slide number 10. So let me summarize. We would like to have a TGFT with a built-in notion of scale, so a non-trivial propagator spectrum, and a notion of discrete connection at the level of the amplitudes, that is to say the spin forms. So the particular realization that we consider, the simpler one, is to implement the gauge constraint only, and supplement this by the non-trivial Laplacian corrections you need to add if you take the paper by Valentin and Joseph seriously. So this defines the Gaussian measure shown in equation 5. And mainly, it can be written as an integral over Schwinger parameter alpha of ultimately the integrand of this integral is a cutoff Bulatov projector, if you want, instead of delta functions you have bit kernels that functions picked on the identity on G with the width given by a square root of alpha, and that's it, and you integrate over alpha. So this is the projector the propagator we will be using.
It's me again, just to get more emphasis on this locality. So here, equation 4, this is a locality requirement in the usual sense. That is, what you're doing here is that you're looking only at some kind of derivative expansion of the kinetic term, and you're truncated looking only at the zero-order term. So there is this extra kind of, you know, it's another type of locality which is built in here.
Okay.
Because in general, you know, you could put any you know, propagator G1 prime. So, you know, in usual space-time, there is an understanding why we have a local expansion. But here, are you going to? I mean, is there such an understanding?
As far as I'm concerned, no. But the choice of propagator is really the weak part of these models, and I would say it's just a conservative choice that we make to study the first examples of such theories. But for example, in four dimensions, it might be that you don't need to introduce additional differential operators, because as I said, the propagator is already non-trivial, so you could use that to define a notion of scale instead. But what I want to emphasize also is that from the point of view of a locality seen as a tensor invariant, as I'm trying to advocate, this operator is really softly breaking this tensor locality. So it's really a parallel we are trying to make with the usual field theories, where you have a local term and soft breaking of these local terms by the differential operators in the propagator, in a sense. So, but I don't have a definitive answer to your questions, I imagine.
Thanks.
Okay. So please go to slide number 11. So if you start from a model like this, the Feynman amplitudes that you generate are labeled by G plus 1 colored graphs. So remember that the vertices are labeled by G colored graphs. And the propagators are a new kind of lines in such a way that you build G plus 1 colored graphs. So I've given an example with three vertices and six internal lines. And the main important notion you need to write the amplitude is the notion of a phase. And a phase is defined as a connected set of alternating of color 0 and color L lines. So color 0 for me here is the dotted lines, so the real propagator lines. And I've given an example in blue. You can see a phase with two lines of color 3, and in a closed phase. And in red, you can see an open face of color 4 with three internal lines. Okay, so from this, we can now talk about the amplitudes themselves in slide number 12. So don't focus too much on the explicit expression. What I want to say, and which is the most important feature, is that the amplitudes ultimately are the integral over Schwinger parameters per line and group elements per line of regularized Bulatov-like amplitudes. And in this way, I mean amplitudes which are given by heat kernels of evaluated at polynomials around spaces. And so this model requires that up to alpha, so to speak, the holonomies should close or should be trivial around the closed faces. You also have a gauge symmetry associated with these amplitudes, which are associated to the vertices of the model, as usual, and this way you can fix part of the individual holonomies associated to the lines to one along the maximal tree of lines. So please go to slide number 13. Now, given that the amplitudes are really like amplitudes associated to two complexes, in this sense, they are associated to they are capturing holonomies built out from individual edge group elements. We need to revise the notion of connectedness that is used usually in usual quantum field theory, where really what matters is the relation between vertices and lines. Here in spin foam, it's a piece of, let's say, of spin foam wisdom. What matters is really the relationship between lines and faces. So we will define a subgraph of a bigger graph G as a subset of lines of G. And now what we will mean by connectedness will be really phase connectedness. And so we define connected components in an abstract way as the subsets of lines of the maximal factorized rectangular blocks of the incidence matrix between lines and faces. So this is a bit formal, but what it means is really that you, given two lines, you will say that they are elementarily connected if they have a common internal face in the subgraph you are considering, and you also require transitivity. So I have given an example with this little graph with three lines, L1, L2, and L3. And if you look at it carefully, you can convince yourself that H1 made of just the line L1 and H12 made of the line L1 and L2 share a common face with lines L1 and L2, so they are connected. But H13 made of the line L1 and L3 has two connected components because there is no face in this graph which goes through both L1 and L3. So please go to slide number 14. So now, the last piece of a graph theoretical thing we need to perform renormalization is the notion of a contraction of a graph. So that is, we want to implement some moves that allow to erase information in our amplitudes at high energies, let's say. And this will be implemented by the so-called dipole move. So let me first explain what a dipole is. A k-dipole is a line appearing in exactly k-1 closed faces. So sorry, there's a misprint here. K-1 closed faces of length 1. So I've given a picture for the d equal 4 case where you have 1 dipoles, 2 dipoles, 3 dipoles, and 4 dipoles. And each of these moves really deletes the corresponding lines and the corresponding internal faces of this graph and reconnect the external faces according to the colors. So I haven't put the colors here, but okay, you should take into account the colors. And from these moves you can define the notion of contraction of a subgraph H included in G by successively contracting all the lines of H. And what I want to emphasize is that the main result of such contractions is that you just erase all the internal lines of H, but you keep the overall structure of G, in particular how external faces going through H are connected together. So this is a type of move which is well suited for cross-graining and renormalization steps because it really allows to erase information contained in tiny loops, tiny faces. And we'll see how it works later on. And as a side remark, I would like to say that we will analyze these moves from a renormalization point of view, but we could as well, and it would be interesting to analyze them from the cross-graining perspective. So please go to slide number 15.
Question?
So now we have, yes.
Question, is this move sufficient to eliminate divergences, or will you need to introduce more complicated moves? Or
they are sufficient in a certain context, and I will explicitly say which ones.
Okay, thank you.
So let me summarize here. So we have a class of models we can play with, and the propagator defines a notion of scale, and the interactions have a notion of locality that we can use to absorb divergences, and finally we have defined a set of moves that allow to rewrite information. So we are ready to explore a bit further the renormalization. So please go to slide number 16. So let me outline the strategy of multi-scale expansion. This is a general scheme for treating divergences in quantum field theory. The first step consists in decomposing amplitudes according to scales, to slices of momenta, so that are given by the Schwinger parameter. We'll see in the next slide. And then in each slice, going from high slices to low slices, you want to replace high divergence subgraphs by effective local vertices, and you iterate the process. So this is really a Wilson renormalization scheme, Wilsonian renormalization scheme, and this gives you an effective multi-series where you have one effective coupling per interaction at each scale. And of course, this can be reshuffled into a renormalized series, where you have just one renormalization per coupling. But I want to emphasize that the advantages of the effective series are essentially twofold. First, it's physically transparent what's going on. You're just erasing some information that you don't see from the scales where you're performing, where you're sitting. And in particular, there is no problem overlapping divergences in these approaches. And it's because we are working with the vertices with the internal structures, there are even more overlapping divergences than in usual cases. So it's quite comfortable to work in the multi-series expansion. And the second step is more technical, is that not only the effective multiseries makes your amplitude finite, but also they don't grow unreasonably in the number of vertices. So please go to slide number 17, where I explain what I mean by a multi-slice expansion of the propagator. So remember that the propagator is an integral over a Schwinger parameter alpha. And so what we can do is to fix some arbitrary constant bigger than one, and decompose the propagators according to slices of alpha. And we take the slices as growing geometrically, and interpret each slice as a given scale. So let's say between 1 meter and 10 meters, between 10 meters and 100 meters, etc. And, now, in this expansion, the covariance, right, C, can be written as a sum over the scale I, given by an index I, of Ci, and C is given by in formula 8. And the natural regularization in this scheme is to just cut off the set of integers I. And really what I want to say also is that I is really a momentum scale. Large I really means in SU2, for example, large J's. This slicing of the propagators translates at the level of the amplitudes as a decomposition of the amplitudes into scale attributions. So for each line E, you choose an index IE, and the set of these indices we call it mu, and it's called a scale attribution, and you recover the full amplitude AG by summing over mu, over the scales mu, an amplitude which is called AG mu. So now we can go to slide 18. The strategy is really to focus now on each amplitude with the scale attribution, and to find the optimal bounds on these amplitudes. So I have given a formal definition of high subgraph, but you don't need to look at it. The definition is really that the high subgraph is a connected connected subgraphs such that the internal scale, that is the indices I in the internal lines, are higher than all the external scales given by the external legs. So I have given an example in the bottom of the slide. On the left, you have a graph with two external legs at scale I, smaller than the internal scale J, given by just one line. And if you see the internal line J as a little spring, that is very tight as compared to the springs of the external legs, you can convince yourself that really if you... A picture way to represent it is to say that the spring forces the internal faces of the graph to shrink, as shown in the picture in the middle, and so that seen from the low scales of the external legs, you can replace the high subgraph with scale J by the simplest graph on the right side of the figure. So these are the type of moves we will implement. That is, we will replace consistently high subgraphs by simpler connected tensor invariants, such that the one on the right part of the figure. However, the problem in these models is that, contrary to usual quantum field theories, the fact that high subgraphs look local from lower scales is not automatic. So, let's go to slide number 19. There are essentially two sources of loss of locality. One is given by the fact that requiring that in high slices the holonomies are really the holonomies around cross spaces are really close to one, not necessarily implies that each individual holonomy is close to one. So this is one thing. So you cannot necessarily contract the corresponding length. And the second source of loss of locality is more of a combinatorial kind. Even if the first dot is ensured, the fact that you are forgetting about some information about the faces might break apart the contracted graph into two disconnected components. So we define two notions. One is the contractibility notation, which is some kind of simple connectedness notion, which tells you that a graph is contractible whenever forcing the holonomy to be trivial forces essentially the individual variables to be trivial. And the second is addresses the combinatorial issue, and it says that a graph is trivial if first it is contractible, and then you don't lose connectedness. So the first definition ensures that a high contractible subgraph can be approximated by a tensor invariant, and the second dot ensures that it can be approximated by a connected tensor invariant. So what is really necessary is that the high subgraphs are contractible. Then the second point is more a question of convenience. So please go to slide number 20.
Just a question about your definition of contractibility. I mean, it's a bit technical, but I don't completely understand, because if I have a tree, the condition that HE is equal to 1 on a tree is a gauge dependent condition. So. And it's always true that if the holonomy, you know, is equal to 1, then I can, you know, I can make a gauge transformation to go. So, it means some gauge dependence somewhere?
Sorry, there is a misprint. It should be, you should read E not in T. That is, I first gauge fix the amplitude, and then for this gauge fix amplitude, we need to see whether the remaining holonomies are fixed to 1. Sorry. Maybe.
Okay.
It is stated, sorry. So please go to slide number 20. So the main power counting theorem that we use in this framework is to really expand to really bound the amplitude at scale mu by m to the power of omega for all all high subgraphs. So omega is really the usual degree of divergence that you have in mind for continuity theories, except that here it's done at every scale, and it takes the scale into account. That's a bit of a technical detail. And here the degree that we found is a minus 2 times the number of lines of the graph plus d times the number of internal faces minus the rank, and this rank is the rank of the incidence matrix. So you see here again that the notion of conductiveness that we adopted is adapted to the discussion of divergences, because the what matters is really the rank of the incidence matrix between lines and faces. And as a side remark, these bounds are optimal for G either abelian or when the graph is contractible. So when omega is strictly smaller than zero, you know that this piece of the graph G won't give any divergent terms. And really, the divergent terms are those given by the subgraph, come from the subgraph given by omega bigger than zero. So, okay.
Could you be a bit more precise about this incidence matrix? You mean, because there's the, you know, the edge, and then there's the strands, and there's the face, so could you give a bit more a definition of this, precise definition of what you mean?
So you take the lines, that is the dotted lines, the propagator lines, and then the set of faces, as I had defined before, and you say that epsilon EF, where E is a line and F is a face, is either plus or minus 1 depending on the orientation when the E is inside F, or 0 otherwise.
So in your recall, the E are the dotted edge, and the F are the non-dotted faces. Is that your definition?
So the E are the dotted edges, and the faces are are collections of lines, but the way they can be recovered from the
dotted lines or not dotted lines?
So ultimately, they are a collection of dotted lines, but you can easily okay. follow their how they are connected by looking at the set of dotted and undotted lines. That is, so you a face is the set of the dotted lines that are in connected components of a set of dotted lines of a given color and undotted lines of a given color and the dotted lines. Probably not so clear, but
it's more precise.
So now we have everything at hand. We can really start looking at some examples. So please go to slide number 21 and slide number 22, where I start to look at the U1 case in four dimensions. So what turns out, if you analyze the divergence degree in this case, is that the amplitude, the divergence is completely due to four dipole moves. Four dipole, and
what is the theory you are considering? I'm sorry.
Go to the slide number 21. I'm considering the that I've defined before. In the case of C, the group being U1, and the rank of the tensor being 4.
So what does it mean for the interaction term? Can you just remind us, because I can't hold everything in mind. So what interaction Lagrangian you are considering here?
The propagator is given by this integral over alpha of heat kernels on U1.
Right, but that is just the Gaussian part.
Yes, and the interactions are any arbitrary finite sets of tensorial invariants in four dimensions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so please go to the slide 22. So we by looking at the degree of divergence, we notice that the divergences are completely fully due to so-called melopoles, and melopoles are just a single vertex graph which can be contracted using only four dipoles. So I have given an example of a vacuum monopole on the bottom of the slide, which just to give you an idea of what's going on here. For example, you can first contract line L1 using a four dipole, and then line L2, then line L3. So you can fully contract the graph using only four dipoles, and this graph is as a single vertex. Please go to slide 23. There is a question from
Marseille. In the interactions, or bringing together any arbitrary set of interactions? I'm confused about what is the statement here.
Sorry, can you?
You're saying the only divergence come from these monopoles. In any graph of the theory, whatever are the set of initial...
Yes. Okay. So the answer is yes. I don't know if you understood. So now please go to slide 23. So forget about the details of the theorem that I'm showing here. The only relevant thing is that non-vacuum divergences really come from these monopoles, as I described, and they are log divergent. And as a corollary, because we start from a finite set of vertices, and that from one vertex you can construct a finite set of monopoles, you infer that the set of possible divergent subgraphs is finite. So we really have a super renormalizable theory here. So, as you might have noticed, and you could notice if you were looking at it carefully, the monopoles are trivial. So they satisfy the condition I was presenting before for the possibility of reabsorbing the divergences into a tensor invariant. Technically, we can perform the renormalization using a weak ordering procedure, which is just a change of a basis of invariance in the interaction, dependent of a cutoff rho. So you just define the omega rho of an invariance by a sum of a different invariance with coefficients depending on rho. And if you go to slide 25, you see that when you define the weak ordered theory with a weak ordered interaction, when you send the cutoff rho to infinity in this way, you recover a finite amplitude at any order. And this is true for any set of finite interaction. So any set totally B that I've noted here, when it is finite, the model is super renormalizable at any order of perturbation theory. So this concludes.
Can you precise what you mean by C rho? What is the rho? What is the C? And how you kind of? Can you make your definitions more clear, please?
So C rho, if you remember,
dependent of C.
Rho is the cutoff on the Schwinger parameter alpha. So it's the UV cutoff in your propagator, and then if you adjust at any cutoff the interaction part of the action, and send this cutoff to infinity, you will recover a finite answer for any amplitude. Is it clear?
So I got what was your propagator. Your propagator was the heat kernel at rho, is that what you're taking? Or it's the integral of the heat kernel? I'm not sure.
Integral,
what is the definition of the propagator? Is it the heat kernel, the integral of the heat kernel?
Integral from m to the power minus 2 rho to infinity of the heat kernel. So, and the integral I'm speaking of is the integral over the time parameter of the kernel.
So there's two scales. There's m and rho. Is that the thing?
No, but m is just it can be any number. M is really like you decide to measure things in terms of power of 10 or powers of e or powers of 2 or whatever. It's just a number bigger than one. It's just a technical thing. It's just a parameter that we use to slice in a geometrical way the propagator, and the M is just the reason of this geometric.
Yeah, but the cutoff you just gave me depends on M minus exponent minus rho, right? So it depends on both. Is that correct?
Yeah,
so the only guy,
So rho is really a cutoff on the, if you want, on high momenta.
But that's M too.
No, M is just a number. You re-express the cutoff as M to some power of rho. But
so rho is not the cutoff then. The cutoff is M to the power minus rho. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Cutoff is M to the power minus 2 rho, if you want.
Okay, so that's the cutoff.
Yeah. Okay, so this concludes the first set of models I wanted to give you a flavor of, and let's go now to the just renormalizable models. So usually these are the most interesting models from a physical perspective. So here the set here is the setting. So we suppose that we are working with the rank D tensors, a group of dimension big D, and we restrict the interaction to a maximal order Vmax. And the question we want to ask is what are the necessary conditions on small D, big D, and Vmax in order to construct just renormalizable models? And let me recall that just renormalizable models are models where that are renormalizable but have, however, an infinite set of divergent graphs. So the notations are as follows. I will call N2k the number of vertices with valency 2k, big N the number of external legs, and H/T is the contracted graph H over along a tree of lines. So this is somehow the gauge fixing. So we can go to slide number 28. So we were able to rewrite the degree of divergence as shown in equations 11, 12, 13. And the main point here is that you have first a contribution that decreases in the number of external legs when D and big D and small D are high enough. And the bounded part, rho, in red. And finally, a contribution that has to be in blue, a contribution in that is a coefficient in front of the number of vertices with valency 2k that has to be positive if you want the theory to be renormalizable. And if you want the theory to be just renormalizable, you require that the number in blue is zero for the highest valency Vmax, so that you can really generate an infinite set of divergent subgraphs. So we fully classified such theories, and they are summarized in the table. So we have five possible combinations of the parameters we are considering. And the one I want to discuss a bit here is the first one, the type A, which has small d equals to 3, that is the dimension of space-time, if you wish, big D equals to 3, so that could be SU2, for example, and Vmax equals to 6. So let's go to slide number 29. Here's the expression for omega for this 5-6 model on SU2 that I want to consider. And I've given for you the table of possible divergences. So you see that you can have 6-point functions, log divergent 6-point functions. You can have up to linearly divergent 4-point functions. And you can have up to quadratically divergent 2-point functions. So, and it turns out that if you study in detail this model, you can renormalize along the lines I've described in more details for the U1 case. And these divergences generate coupling constants flow, as well as mass and wave function counterterms. So it's really a non-trivial kind of renormalizability. Okay, so this concludes this section, and let's go to the conclusion on slide number 30. So let me summarize. First, I have introduced models which feature connection degrees of freedom and generate spin forms with connection degrees of freedom. These models are generically more renormalizable than their counterparts without connection degrees of freedom. And two particular examples that we studied are the U1-4D models, which are super renormalizable whatever the interaction, as long as it's a finite set of interactions. And we uncovered five types of OCD just renormalizable models, including one, the SU2 model in D equals to 3, which is renormalizable. So what we want to do in the near future is to first study the flow of this SU2 model in 3D and understand whether it's asymptotically free, just like the simpler counterparts of these models. And the second question, which would really need more work, is to try to relate this model to the Ponzano ray general and to 3D quantum gravity in general, because we have modified a bit the structure. A second line of research is to try to construct these models, that is to not only analyze the divergences of the amplitudes, but also to try to make the renormalized series summable in some sense. So this is, I think, work being done by Pat Van. And finally, the most interesting point, of course, is to try to generalize these structures to 4D gravity models, including like EPRL, FK, or any other model. And the first thing to do in these problems is to try to understand better the interplay between the simplicity constraints and the tensor invariants, because we saw already that introducing the gauge invariants modifies a lot the kind of QFT tools that you need to use to perform a normalization. And it might be that simplicity constraints modify them further. And another point to understand is really the choice of propagator. Do we need just the constraints, or do we need to add some differential operators such as this Laplacian? This is really an open question that we need to study. And I thank you for your attention on slide 31.
Questions?
Hello, this is Joseph from Perimeter. I would like to comment just a few things here. First, Sylvain, when you put your gauge invariant condition, you improve renormalizability, do you mean you improve the power counting theorem, or what do you mean by that?
I just mean that the model that without this gauge condition is just renormalizable, as you showed. It turns out to be super renormalizable to any order. So this is simply that. So the power counting is improved, and as a result, just renormalizable theories are turned into a super renormalizable one, and so on. So, and for example, in 3D, you could go only to 5.4, and we can go to 5.6. That's just what I mean.
Okay, I have two questions, one which is technical and another one which is more technical. First of all, your equation, your row, you know, your function row, which appears in equation 13, slide 28. Do you have an explicit expression for that? Do you have a bound on it? How did you manage to know? Is it the sum of genera or of the jackets as we perform, or something else? And exactly, I will give you to you, and it's actually about where does the non-Hamiltonian feature of the SU2 comes in this structure? I didn't see it. Do you mean that that's not necessary? So that's my 2 points. Thank you.
So we have an expression for rho, but we didn't use an expression in terms of jackets. We just showed inductively the equation 14, that is that rho is bounded by zero, and it saturates to zero only in the case of of the graphs being melonic. So that's what we use. And what is the second question? Sorry.
Is the divergence depend on the fact that G is abelian or non-abelian?
So in
your counting, it seems totally independent of it.
So in this case, it does not matter at all because the so what did I want to say? So the abelian power counting that we are using here is really identical to the non-abelian power counting when the graphs are contractible. What I've the definition, or if you want, a simply connected. And it turns out that in these models, the only divergent graphs in the abelian sense are simply connected. And so really the bound that we have is saturated, and so the power counting does not depend on the non-commutativity of the group in this case.
Okay, question.
Which is related. I mean, you studied here only the normalizability of, colored model. And let's say in dimension 3 for SU2, this does not include the Bulatov-Oguri model because the vertex of Bulatov-Oguri would be a tetrahedra. So can you now use your techniques and look at the normalizability of Bulatov-Oguri and, what do you expect there to happen?
Tough question. I don't really know. So it's true that we are going away from the usual Bulatov model in this case. But as I try to emphasize, we are just modifying a feature which is not very compelling, I would say, because we are just working with simplicial interactions because it's simple or because it's natural in some sense. But there is no strong symmetry. Reason or symmetry prescription for why we are trying this. So we are really trying to one symmetry prescription and trying to understand what it means and what it gives. But of course it's a bit arbitrary at this stage. And studying the
as a first step to simplify. But I mean the question is whether this simplification is generic. That is whether having simplified the Bulatov-Oguri type model interaction. Lead to the same behavior, or really it's a drastically different type of model than the one you're looking at?
This I don't know. So what's sure is that you can re-express, for example, the Bulatov model you can start from the colored Bulatov model, integrate out fields, and re-express it as a, in this fashion with a sum of interactions that are labeled by colored graphs, but they won't be at least they won't be naively tensor invariants. So I don't know whether, in some sense, the two models are the same, but a priori they are not. So I don't know. So and I'm not sure these specific techniques we are using could apply to the Bulatov model. I'm not sure. We have not tried yet.
This is Joseph again. I would like just to come on that question of Laurent. I don't have a definitive proof, but the point is I don't think that we will find certainly, this is what I want to say, some divergent contribution coming from the Bulatov model, which cannot be recast in terms of the interaction of Bulatov. So it's in that sense, it's not renormalizable. Have some example. Well, now you have to find a good proof of that. Actually, that's definitely the proof that it's not normalizable, actually. If you find some interaction, some terms, some amplitude, some graph amplitude to diverge and cannot be recast in terms of the interaction. So I think it's done for the Bulatov model by himself. The strong point here about those types of interaction, they are self-similar, okay? When you combine them, you contract them, they're coming back to tensor invariant. This is a strong point. The vertex of Bulatov is not of that kind. Okay.
Can I ask a more naive question? If any of these models have a continuum limit in terms of a classical theory of space-time, There are several numbers here that could be clues as to what the dimensionality of that space-time could be. It could come from the maximum vertex from the dimension of the group, or from the number of indices of the tensor. What should I be thinking if I'm trying to think about how to make a correspondence, or when there might be possible a correspondence with the theory of space-time?
A priori, the dimension of space-time should be the small d, that is the rank of the tensors. That is, I mean, at least this is how they are built. They are built to reproduce simplicial quantum gravity amplitudes, and the dimensions of the simplicial complexes is given by the rank of the tensors.
Right, but then we would be looking for a theory where also the gauge group had something to do with the symmetries of a space-time of that dimension, and the degree of the maximal vertex also was somehow consistent with what you would expect from a renormalizable quantum field theory in that dimension, and I don't see any match above three dimensions in your table.
I don't know, but definitely if you want to construct 4D models, for example, they would be out of this table, because this table is for models where you don't implement the simplicity constraints.
Should I be concerned that you have dimensions, you have renormalizable models for dimensions 5 and 6, whereas there are no ordinary quantum field theories in dimension 5 or 6 that are renormalizable, except free theories? Should that be a concern?
I don't think so. I don't see why, at least, but I don't know.
Well, because it means these models can't have a continuum limit in terms of the normalizable quantum field theory of the same dimension.
Sorry, yeah, can I
but anyway, we...
Hello?
Sorry?
It's Daniele here. Can I comment on the comment by Lee?
Yes.
Sure.
I mean, I think that it's very dangerous to try to import the conventional wisdom, because what you're talking about are ordinary local quantum field theories on space-time. What we're talking about here is quantum field theories which are non-local in the usual sense, so there is a generalized different notion of locality defined on a group manifold, which is not directly related to any space-time manifold.
No, Daniela, I understand that, but what I'm wondering is if these models have some limit, which is a quantum field theory on a space-time of a given dimension, or reduces to a classical theory of a space-time of a given dimension, you should expect some sort of correspondence, and I'm wondering,
sure,
maybe we don't expect any correspondence.
So of course, I agree with the question, and indeed we are all asking the same question. But it is hard to draw any conclusion about this question from the randomizability itself of this type of field theories. You have to extract some effective physics. Whether or not that involves a phase transition remains to be seen. But in any case, it's not the randomizability itself that will tell you anything about that. So it's not something we can even guess an answer only by looking at this result.
So, my answer to the question of Lee is that for the models in 5 and 6 dimensions that are presented here, if you take seriously the fact that the additional degrees of freedom that are present in spin forms as opposed to tensor models, that is the notion of gauge invariance and the geometric constraints play an important role in the continuum limit, then you don't expect models D and E to have a nice continuum limit in terms of a space-time continuum limit. So I wouldn't be worried.
Okay, so you just don't expect it. Okay, thank you.
But just along the same line, both to kind of Daniel and Sylvain, so let's go back to the super renormalizable theories, which you have so much control on. Is there any space-time understanding, at all, of those, of any of those models, right? Because you have several candidates, because you could just For the interaction term, you could choose any tensor invariant. So, I mean, in space-time terms, it may be non-local, but still, is there any contact at all for this for these models with in terms of space-time?
So for UN models, they don't have anything to do with space-times in the sense of metrics, of course, because we work with the UN.
Not metrics, just so some topological field theory involving UNs, and that has some interpretation in space-time, or I don't know. So not interpretation in terms of quantum gravity, but just in terms of some field theory which comes out in some limit or something.
Interesting point here is that these colored models, these tensor invariant models, they are generically dominated by well-behaved topologies, that is, manifolds, and not only manifolds, but also manifolds with trivial topology. So, in some sense, they generate the right topology. But now we have to understand how to put some metric data or some geometric data on these topologies.
Do you mean? I mean to continue with the question of Abai, which is I think the key question is here you're doing renormalizability, and at some point in the beginning, you were saying I'm doing continuum limit. So that's why I guess these questions are triggered. So now to comment on your last point, you're saying the divergence are you know driven by the melons, right? This melopole or melonic graph, right? That's what you refer to. Is that what you refer to?
Yes, sure.
So the problem is that if I look at this melon graph, they are essentially one-dimensional. That is, you know, these are they have the space. If you really draw down the property of this melon graph, they have the property that if I cut out two little triangle anywhere in the or two little tetrahedra or two little vertex anywhere in the graph, then I can completely separate the graph. Which means that you know every in some sense two triangles are always. They are nowhere near any triangulation of let's say round sphere or something like that. They're in some sense completely crumpled phase. So I hope you don't expect these ones to be the one because these ones cannot be the one on which space time arrives. They have no you know space time extension at all.
I agree with you if you interpret them literally. That is as really elementary blocks of some unit. Volume, but it might be that first the interplay between the geometric data we are trying to add and this combinatorial thing changed a bit the perspective. So this I don't know.
But
and
I mean, imagine a big triangulation made of all sorts of simplicial manifolds. If I take at random two vertex. What I'm going to or two little tetrahedra, they are not going to be connected. They are going to be two small holes in my manifold far apart. If my manifold is really as an extension, you know, almost in fact never I will continuum limit. I will never be able to find two tetrahedra that cut the manifold in half. So all I'm saying, independently of the metric interpretation, there's no metric interpretation. It's a topological interpretation. These melonic graphs do not correspond to a large manifold in any sense. That's you know it's beautiful that they control the renormalizability, but they are essentially as big as a point in some sense. They have no extension. So
okay,
geometrically, we are very far from what Abai or Lee is asking, it seems to me.
Is the right intuition that these divergences are more like infrared divergences than ultraviolet divergences because they afflict diagrams with which are pieces of propagators rather than higher-order interactions?
I'm just
looking for an interpretation of what Laurent just said.
I'm thinking about the combinatorial structure of this melon graph, which are really, imagine a big, big, big triangulation with zillions of triangle, 2D, and then take out two random triangles, it will cut the melon in half. So this is not, you know, if you have in mind a picture of a large triangulation, and if you take randomly two triangles, you're just creating two holes. So the melons are very, very, very special.
they're very crumpled. They don't correspond to an extended sphere or they correspond to something very, very singular, or like a triangulation which is completely folding onto itself, onto one point. They have there's no space there.
But does this mean that apart from these very crumpled configurations, the theory is finite? So could you say this by saying that the divergences occur only in a set of diagrams which are very far from the classical configurations?
Yeah, but they dominate. That's the problem. That's the one that in some sense dominates the whole randomizable theory.
Divergence, because they're divergent ones.
Yeah, but they are the ones that are left over.
Laurent Lee, this is Carlo. If you don't mind, I'd like to add one comment. Maybe then we should listen to Sylvain. It seems to me that if you start from the Pontano ledger picture, you think of the spikes, and then you go to the spin fold picture, you find exactly these one way of viewing these Mellon graphs. So I think that there are two confusions here, in my opinion. One is between ultraviolet and infrared in two sense. In gravity, of course, you can have a very small region of space-time from which you have a big spike which is very large. So it's infrared in the sense that you have large J, large spins, large areas, large volumes, and if ultraviolet in the sense that it can be confined in a very small region of a surrounding space. So these are the divergences we are talking about here, it seems to me. And these are the ones which are controlled in these models, and these are the ones that also may affect geometrical models. A separate thing is I agree with what you were saying before about there's a certain tension between the technical results, which are very beautiful here, which are very nice, and the initial philosophy about the continuum limit. It seems to me this is not about the continuum limit. This is about the normalizability of large J, which is what is called ultraviolet, of course, by Rivasseau and his people, because it's large J is ultraviolet in the group, and is infrared in the sense that it's large, something large geometrically. So it's called ultraviolet. It's called infrared by us, in spite of the fact that it can be confined in a small region. So this is about the consistency and the normalizability of the theory. Sort of local in space-time has nothing to do, in my opinion, with the continuum limit so far. And I would like to know what Sylvain thinks about that.
So I have to agree that so far it doesn't give us a continuum limit, but at least it gives us a control over the field theory, and we can start running out the randomization flow and see whether the Mellons are dominating until arbitrary cutoffs, or whether there is a phase transition at some point that goes to a more less crumpled things, or what? I mean, this is the deep unknown, so I don't have anything definitive to say about that.
I think it could be that situation just like QED. I mean, there are ultraviolet divergences; they can be controlled. There is a normalization problem. This is perfectly fine. It has nothing to do with the continuum limit and the large-scale behavior of the electromagnetic field and the electrons. It could also be that. I mean, I think one should take seriously all these results, even if one doesn't believe at all this picture about a phase transition giving a continuum limit. I think the two things are separate, and they're much more interesting if they're seeing separate. And this also relates, in my opinion, to the original question by Abai. Somehow, these results are very good also if it is correct, the hypothesis that there's a short-scale structure, there's a plug-scale structure, the series is discrete, the series is correctly discrete, and the continuum limit is just the standard continuum limit of a quantum theory which has a discrete scale at which the quantum phenomena appears. So what I'm saying is that we do have a problem of large J affecting the amplitudes, also in the finite models, also in the models which are which have no divergences like the ones with the cosmological constant, still relevant. So this analysis of large J, you know, normalization of large radiative corrections are relevant, independently of the idea or not that one should have a continuous limit, which several people think is not a relevant idea.
I agree with that. So what you are really doing here first is to make the groove field theories well defined as field theories. So we can you can write compute things which are independent of the cutoff you're working with, if you are far from this cutoff, of course. And now the second hope, which I agree with, is not necessarily related, is to use these renormalization techniques to explore the phase diagram of these models. And maybe we can find a continuous phase this way. At least it gives us more tools to explore the question.
Maybe I can comment on what Sylvain says to Carlo. I think there's two issues there. There's the one you mentioned, which is, you know, ultraviolet and infrared. But there is somehow a discovery that there's something else. There's a discovery that these guys have shown, which is that in fact it's possible to really kind of recast the whole summation in terms of subsets of diagrams, right? Which are these Mellons. So, and in some sense, it's valid that weak coupling. So in some sense, it is achieving this resummation. The problem is that in the phase where the Mellons dominate, there is no space-time. So it is completely crumpled. The crumpling here has nothing to do with the one you were talking about in infrared ultraviolet. It's really this somehow non-local behavior of the field theory. So this is the thing I was worried about. I was not worried about the confusion between, you know, a language between small local in J and large in spin. But so they have this finding that, in fact, Mellons dominate, but Mellons are zero-dimensional in some sense. So
why do you say, for example, if I take a three-sphere, okay, I break it into tetrahedra, and then I start doing Mellonic subdivision over and over and over and over again, I still have a three-sphere. I'm just doing a three-sphere. There's nothing crumpled about it.
This is a triangulation which has the property it has. It is in any topology you're going to put on the graph, it's one-dimensional. It has the property. Think about the two-sphere with lots of small triangle, Carlo, and take two triangle out. What do you get? You get a two-sphere with two holes, right?
Well, maybe we should continue that in private, not in by phone. Yeah. I think one can take an N-sphere and do Mellonic subdivision, and it remains an M.
Just saying that everybody, I mean, Sylvain said it, and you can talk to anybody in GFT, they agree that these Mellons are completely crumpled phase. So that's just somehow facts of what these Mellons are.
I have another question about this. Once the question of, in ordinary quantum field theory, where the divergences are, is not what dominates the low-energy behavior of the quantum field theory, because if the theory is renormalizable, one removes the divergences, replaces them with finite numbers multiplying vertices, and then one has an effective theory which is dominated by dimensional analysis, by whatever dominates dimensional analysis. So the fact that the divergences appear in the Mellons doesn't necessarily imply that once they're renormalized away, that what dominates is the crumpled diagrams. Or am I missing something?
Maybe, but so far the analysis that has been done, the large N limit is just the crumpled phase. So,
I agree about the large N, but that hasn't played a role here so far.
Right. So, I mean, you know, there's the hope that there's some kind of phase transition where what you're saying is true, that the Mellons do not dominate. But this is the challenge in some sense, as I see it in this, you know, business.
Yeah, I kind of feel that, I mean, I think we're all converging to the same similar thing, in Sylvain, Daniel, Oriti included, namely that this really is very beautiful mathematical results on controlling these divergences of theories which fundamentally live on these group manifolds. So at the zeroth level, they have nothing to do with space-time.
and our intuition may not be right coming from space-time. But I think we're all also being a little bit more greedy and feel that, well, this should be more than just mathematical physics and have some interpretation in space-time. And for the super-normalizable theory, I don't particularly care if, in fact, the interpretation is in terms of any metrics or anything, but some gauge fields in space-time. And I personally feel that rather than just waiting, I mean, of course, one should do the detailed calculations, but at the same time, one should sort of think about, well, what could it be, right? What could that theory be, some non-local theory in space-time built out of these U1 connections? Which presumably is topological because there's no metric interpretation. So one can start kind of writing down some conjectures, right, and then see if there is a behavior like that, quite apart from systematically taking the renormalization group flow and see if, in fact, there is a phase transition. And my problem is basically I can't think of anything which may look like these theories, right? I mean, what is even a candidate, if you like?
Well, one thought is Kirill's kind of non-local theories, which can be written just as functions of the gauge field. But I don't know that there are any non-trivial ones. I don't know if Kirill is on the line, but I don't know if there are any non-trivial examples when the group is only U1.
But even before that, even notion of, I think what Abba is asking is any notion of extended space-time, which is, you know, why I'm, you know, worried about these melons, like.
But we could just have a metaphor with U1 connection on it and try to write an interesting class of theories with non-local interactions. The only thing I can think of is using Kirill's strategy, but I once played with that with U1 and didn't get anywhere. I don't know if Kirill is connected and wants to comment.
But of course, this is in three dimensions, three space-time dimensions. But I think one can still, I agree with Lee and with Laura that I don't see any candidates, but that worries me really. I mean, in the sense that I would think that if in fact we're going to arrive by hook or crook, by some method, by looking at the group flow and phase transition or something, at some theory, and if we can't even think of such a theory, then I'm not so, I'm a little bit worried. Of course, it's not a proof because, of course, mathematics often is much more clever than we are. And maybe there's such a theory exists, but that is the kind of thing that worries me about this kind of program. I mean, it's beautiful mathematical physics, but I think we're all more greedy than just that, right? We would like to get some real contact with space-time physics if possible.
Can I comment on that? Actually, I would like to understand a little bit better from Abai what is the worry, in the sense that we are using this simpler U1 models, and even the simpler ones that are U1 without any gauge projection, only as a training ground for applying these techniques to the existing spinform models reformulated within the GFT framework. So it could well be that these simplified models do not have or do not even suggest any continuum physics. Really, we are taking them only as a testing ground of techniques, only to learn. Then I can ask the same question, what is the suggested effective continuum theory for the existing group field theory models, for the PRL model, or for the model with Aristide, for any other four-dimensional model we like for other reasons. And it would be similarly hard to guess from the form of the group field theory what is the effective theory in the continuum. But if we've been right in writing down the amplitudes, well, we have arguments for saying that it should be GR. But we are on the same ground as guessing the effective continuum theory from spinform models.
I think if you say that, well, this super renormalizable U1 models are just, not toy models, they're interesting theories, but they really do. You don't even expect them to have a space-time interpretation, but you just want to get handle on techniques and so on. Then I have no question. I mean, I was, again, being greedy, and I was hoping that already one might see some glimpse at this level, and at least at the zeroth level.
Maybe
where I was,
can.
Okay,
maybe
when I was racking my head, I couldn't see anything.
It could be that one can, but we didn't think hard about that because we were not trying to see the physics in them. Conversely, if it happens that they have no such physics, in them in itself would not say much about the more complicated models, which have an independent justification for the ingredients or the form of the amplitudes and so on.
But just to query, your U1 models have n separate U1 fields, isn't that correct?
One field. Yes.
Okay.
No, one field over U1 to the...
Yes, one field over U1.
One field over U1 to the n.
To 4, yeah, in this case.
So over U1 to the 4. Okay, so there is some scope to play around there.
Yeah, I think it's mathematical. It's very, very interesting. So, I mean, again, as I was saying, we're just trying to be more greedy, that's all. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thanks.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Sylvain again.